Well, good evening.
I thought that this evening we would take a little time to explore together something that I think is of great significance, not only individually, but also collectively. I imagine everybody here that we all know in our own way what it is like to have a center. Generally, we call the center me. Sometimes we'll call ego, self. We have different names for this center. I like the word center because it has no extra meaning, you know? Ego has so many ideas, so many thoughts, so many theories surrounding it. But center, I think everybody knows what it's like to have a center, to function from that center, whatever we call that center. Everybody knows what it's like to function from the standpoint of me. So that's what I mean when I'm talking about the center. And most human beings function their entire lives from that center. From the time it gets created, very young, it becomes a center from which all of life is lived from. That's the common way. And so the center is constantly interpreting each moment of our lives. It's deciding whether it's good or bad, advantageous or not advantageous, if it's what I want or don't want. This center, this interpreter, is deciding whether what is should be or whether it shouldn't be. It's in a constant state of judgment. Have you noticed any of this? It's scanning always perception, looking for what's advantageous for itself. You see? We call this self-centeredness. But I don't like the word self-centeredness, even though it's a very accurate word, but it has so many overtones in our culture of judgment. You know? If someone says that you're self-centered, it's always said judgmentally, isn't it? It's like someone's slighting you or something. Of course, self-centeredness is nothing more than being self-centered. You know? Functioning from that center, that constant narrator. And this has great significance. As I said, it has great significance not only for people individually, but also collectively. Because it's the center from which all of humanity's insanity issues forth from. It's sorrow, it's pain, it's suffering, it's hate, it's ignorance, it's greed, on and on. So if we look at this center, if we explore this center, it's very rare that we actually explore something, that we inquire into it, that we look at it. Usually when we're thinking about center or ego, self, we're not really exploring it. We're not really looking at it. What we're doing is trying to solve it or change it or modify it or perfect it or purify it or some. There's always another agenda, and of course the agenda belongs to the center. The agenda of trying to get rid of the center belongs to the center, right? Egos trying to get rid of egos. And so it's very rare that we actually enter into an attitude of discovery where we're not starting from the known, from what we think we know, from what we believe we know, but we're starting from a totally clear slate. So we're starting from a point of awareness rather than a point of the mind, of memory. This has its own challenge, does it not? Just this one thing. Because this center, this me, It really doesn't want to really look at itself very clearly. It just wants to solve itself, right? What can I do about myself? How can I be happy? How can I be well-adjusted? How can I get what I want in life? And then if it becomes spiritual, then it's, I don't have time to look at myself. How do I awaken? How do I become enlightened? How do I have union with God? How do I have everlasting bliss? How do I find my soulmates? It's just the same thing. It's just the same old dance, but it just puts spiritual clothing on. Tell me, a teacher, how do I meditate well, the center says. What should I do? So from the center's position, it never has any time to actually look at itself. Because it's always trying to solve something. It's always trying to modify its experience. I think this is pretty obvious, is it not? This isn't hidden knowledge. All one has to do is open their eyes and see, and you begin to see it, you know. And of course, centers love to aggrandize themselves by becoming something. You know, centers love to have identifications, calling cards. Are you a Democratic or a Republican center? You see? Are you Christian, Hindu, Jew, Buddhist, atheist, agnostic? What are you? The center loves to choose among those. Well, let me see. I'll try being a Christian for a while. See how that goes for me. Then if that doesn't work, I'll be a Buddhist. And if it doesn't work, you know, maybe I'll become an Advaitist, you know. Non-duality will become my new theology. My new form of fundamentalism. Don't mistake. There's as many non-dual fundamentalists as there is any other kind of fundamentalist. We think just because it comes from the East that it can't be the same kind of fundamentalism as everybody else, but when you really look at it, you realize, yes, it can, and it has, and it does. So that's the difficulty of really looking at something. Because the thing we're looking at keeps wanting to solve itself. It has an agenda. It has something that it wants to attain. So it's very difficult. It never has time to look at itself. Maybe very briefly. Its agenda might even become something very spiritual. Being compassionate, kind, still, peaceful. And yet still, there it is in the center. Maybe this center gets a couple of powerful spiritual experiences. Then the center has the next question, how do I hold on to these? How do I get it back? Sound familiar? How do I sustain it? How to be in that lovely state that I discovered at some point, or that found me at some point, how do I stay in that? You see, so the center turns everything into a problem. Funny, isn't it? I mean, it would be funny if it wasn't so tragic, I suppose. It takes ownership of everything that it likes, you know? So initially, when we really have the wherewithal to look at it, if we really look very clearly, very simply, without agenda, without judgment, we begin to see it's the whole, this whole thing I'm calling center, whether you call it ego, self, whatever you call it, that it's a purely psychological phenomena. It's not something like a hand. It's not like something like a foot or a sock even, or a microphone. You can't touch it. You can't grasp it. You can't often really find it. You can't necessarily lose it, unfortunately, for So it's a very difficult thing to define because it is a psychological phenomena. It's just, it's a movement of mind. You ever asked yourself, like, what happens to me when I forget about me? All those moments of the day when I'm not thinking about me, of course, for most people, they're extraordinarily brief moments. Do you know? But what happens to me? Where did I go? When you went to bed, where did you go? You disappeared, you see, because your mind had to do, had to take a break. Your thought system had to take a break. It had to relax. It had to have a break from you. If it doesn't get a break from you, it goes nuts, and about 3 or 4 days without sleep, it starts hallucinating, and it starts to imagine things that aren't there, and all sorts of strange phenomena happens to the most sane person, you know. Often we miss the most extraordinary things because they're so obvious and they're so, in a certain sense, ordinary. You know? If you were to stop thinking for 5 seconds, and if you were stopped to thinking for 5 seconds, you would see, what is it that disappears when I stop thinking? See, usually we're so interested in acquiring, are we not? How do I stop thinking for more than 5 seconds? Which is entirely the wrong question. That's just the center wanting to get something right. But in those, if we stop thinking for 5 seconds or even 2 seconds, when we stop thinking, what falls away? In those 5 seconds, what's not there? It's an amazing 5 seconds. If you were really to look at it, what you realize if you stop thinking for only 5 seconds, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. If your mind was to stop for 5 seconds, you looked at it instead of trying to sustain it or get lost in the next thought, you would start to see that your entire world disappeared. I don't mean necessarily the world you can touch and see and smell, but I mean your entire psychological world. Have you ever looked at this? It's quite extraordinary. In those 5 seconds, you're not a mother, a father, a sister, a brother, Republican, Democratic, Christian, Hindu, Jew, good person, bad person. You have no history. You have no future. It's all not there. See, it's not theology. It's just not there in those 5 seconds without thinking about it. It's just literally not there. Don't worry, it'll be come back. It has an amazing way of resurrecting itself, you know. Every morning you get up, you know, resurrection. It's like, oh darn, you're still here, aren't you? So often we will observe, but we're so intensely trying to observe correctly, to be aware, that we're not actually aware of what we're aware of. Does that make any sense? It's like, you know, most people in their lives at some strange moment in time, actually it happens quite often, your thought processes will take a break every now and then. It may only be for a few seconds, maybe for 5 seconds, but it'll happen. But we never notice what happens in those 5 seconds. We never notice the significance of what falls away. I imagine if we noticed this, the significance of what falls away, most people would come out of those 5 seconds in abject terror because their entire life will have disappeared, their psychological life, in those 5 seconds. And they'll have no answer as to where it went. And whether they know consciously, but probably intuitively, they had some unconscious knowing, if they really saw this, of how ephemeral this entire psychological world is. Extraordinarily ephemeral. As soon as thought stops, it stops. And when it stops, it's not there. It's not like when your hand stops, it's still there. When your psychological world stops, it's not there, because all it is, it's just that movement of mind. That's all it is. And that's usually what we're functioning from, most human beings. Is that not what we're usually functioning from? Now, of course, if we've seen this even once, it will bring up the question, well, if I disappear when I stop thinking, what am I? Because certainly you just didn't fall over and drop dead when you stop thinking about yourself, fortunately. It's nice, isn't it? Can you imagine if you stopped thinking about yourself, you'd actually keel over dead? That would be the ultimate anxiety, right? Then your question wouldn't be, how do I stop thinking? Your question would be, how do I never stop thinking? Because if I'll keel over dead, my heart will stop. So clearly we don't necessarily keel over dead. Our physical existence doesn't disappear. It doesn't stop functioning just because our psychological existence stops functioning for a moment. And if we see this, then we'll see in those 5 seconds that that we take our psychological functioning to actually be more real than our physical functioning. That's where we human beings think our reality is, the reality of who we are, of what's right, of what's wrong, of what's good, of what's bad, of our whole inner environment. That's our world. That's our existence. But if that existence can disappear when you stop thinking about yourself, then it brings into the entire question of what is it that you are then. If what you are can disappear, then it couldn't actually be what you are, could it? And it disappears many times a day, it's just that we usually don't notice it. We stop thinking for these brief moments. But the center, the self, is very adept at reconstituting itself, resurrecting itself, and going on as if nothing happened, you know? As if I didn't actually disappear. My whole entire world didn't actually disappear, you see? It didn't happen. That's kind of what our center continually, unconsciously, I suppose, says. I say this has great significance because when we really start to see, not so much understand through an intellectual process, but we actually see into the nature of this center, into the nature of this self, then we'll see the great significance. The significance of it, as I said, the significance of it for you, for each individual, because it is the realm in which sorrow and suffering and hate and ignorance and greed and lack of compassion and all of that, that's where it's issuing forth from. And of course, collectively, it's extraordinarily significant because it's a whole collection of centers functioning that perpetuate the exterior forms of hate and ignorance and greed and acquisition and degradation and all the rest. So historically, and up till the present time, we're still doing this. We're trying to solve our exterior problems through a modification of thinking. We go from one ideology to the next ideology, from one political system to another political system, and so it goes. But the center is completely intact. I'm not saying that all thoughts are equal, that some thoughts are, there are thoughts that are more or less true. None of them are completely true. So when the old and the present spiritual teaching encourages us to look within, generally what happens when we look within, it's the center that looks into the center. Maybe some of you noticed when you first started doing, maybe some of you haven't done this, but if you ever have done any kind of awareness practice, imagine all of you are so advanced you never even had to do any of that, but for those two or three of you that did do some awareness practice, you know, one of the first things you often notice is how horrendously noisy you are. Often the first discovery of awareness practice isn't like a wonderful discovery. It's like a rude, you know, it's a coming to Jesus moment, as they may say. Not really coming to Jesus, but, you know. You go, my God, I didn't know I was that much of a wreck. I didn't know my mind was nearly that conflicted. I didn't know that I couldn't stop thinking. I didn't know how judgmental I was. I didn't know until I started this dreadful awareness practice and I became much more conscious than I wanted to be. The advertising sounded good, so I fell for it, but what I became conscious of was quite, you know, uncomfortable, disquieting. Maybe later down the line, your center, your ego, decides how to use that awareness to focus itself, you know, so much. It kind of can focus itself to the point where it pretends like all the distraction has disappeared, you know. I'm focused on my eating. Crunching of the vegetables in my mouth. You know, swallowing. Lovely. I mean, I suppose for some people that's great, you know. For me, it just led to kind of a sort of psychological constipation. Do you know where you're just like so hyper self-aware that it's just annoying and aggravating and you feel like the most unspontaneous being in the world, do you know? Because you used to just chew your food and swallow it and now you're like mindfully chewing, you know. And like I said, there are things to be gained from that. I'm not judging it as bad, but it also comes with this other thing, is that often we become, it heightens a sense of a center. So when we start to look at this, and I'm sure many of you have looked at this before, and you start to see that this whole center, this whole thing called me is just it's a psychological phenomena. It's just quickly and conditionally conditioned movements of mind. And of course, since your body is a duplicating machine for your mind, that you tend to feel what you think. You ever noticed? You don't usually have a thought that says, I hate that person, and you don't feel anything. Your body duplicates, turns that thought into actual emotion. Your physicality actually changes. It turns a thought into a feeling. Right? It's like turning water into wine or straw into gold. Your body can turn a thought into a very real lived experience. Right? We do it all the time. Which is one of the difficulties of seen clearly, is because most of us, we access one of two places to find out what's true. We either access our mind or we access how we feel. But if one is duplicating the other, have you ever felt things that really weren't very true? You know? You're in high school or something, you know. God, I think she looked at me. Yes, I'm pretty sure she did look at me. It was only for a second, but and then she smiled, so I think she probably likes me. And then you feel that swelling of the heart chakra, right? That excitement, maybe she, oh, yes, I'm sure, right? And then if we fast forward, you would later to discover that she has no idea of your existence. Do you know? But you had this very real feeling. So So our feelings don't necessarily tell us what's true any more than our minds do. But the beauty is when we begin to see this, we begin to realize that this whole thing of me, it's a psychological process, it's a phenomena created in mind, duplicated in the body. And yet it's very ephemeral, and the whole thing can come to a stop for moments, and often does. Believe it or not, people actually forget about themselves from time to time. A moment of being taken by beauty or awe, or maybe just the silence of a snowy day just is experienced in its beautiful simplicity. And there's total quiet for a moment. Sometimes quiet can even come during moments of great, great trial, very difficult moments, a moment that feels very much like an emergency. And sometimes when something's a sort of almost a life or death emergency, there can be a stopping too. So it can be something beautiful or something challenging. And in those moments where the whole process stops, where everything becomes still for a moment, that everything you ever thought you were, your whole inner world is not functioning at that point. It's not happening because the mind isn't moving. And at those moments, you may see, my goodness, that whole sense of myself was derived just from the movement of thought. And when it stops, something's still here, something's still alive. So if something's still here, when all of it stops, if something's still awake, conscious, then clearly you couldn't be that whole movement. Because it can stop and you'll still be there to notice that it stopped. And then we look, what is that that notices when the whole movement stops? Our mind expects to find, it expects to find another kind of center, another self. But when we really look before the thoughts, before the whole psychological process, we see that there isn't an alternative self. There isn't a spiritual self there. There isn't another center there. If we really look within, we'll look for ourselves and we won't find ourselves as a thing, as a psychological process, an emotional process, an entity. All that stops when the mind stops. And I'm not saying that it should stop. I'm just saying that it does stop when the mind stops. So it's entirely a mentally made phenomena. And yet there you are, whatever you are, is still there. And at such moments, it may dawn on you there may be this very simple shift of perception, we could say, where you realize, it's not that you believe it, it's not that you've been convinced, but you realize, because you've touched upon its obviousness, that you are not a something that can be found, not an entity, not a someone. All that exists in the mind. That you are indeed present, but you're not present as a thing. You know that there isn't actually someone who is conscious, who is conscious. There isn't someone who is aware, that you'll never find it as anything more than a thought. I mean, if there isn't something or someone that's aware, that's conscious, if you were to see it, again, not be convinced by it, but just see it, then it's just possible that you get that taste, that sense, that simple shift of recognition. That what you are isn't a thing. Now, what you want to call that doesn't matter. You can call it awareness or consciousness or Buddha nature or spirit or whatever the heck you want to call it. And I'm sure there's any number of people in this room that have had such shifts. They may have been permanent, they may not have been permanent. But they're not really all that uncommon, actually, for people that are willing to look into the nature of their experience. Now, it would be lovely, wouldn't it, if that was the end of the story? Just do that, and then go home and have a great life and do what you will. That the center doesn't give up that easy. The center can be very alluring. Have you noticed? It's very seductive. Has a gravitational pull to it. And so you can be in a moment of great spiritual clarity, and in the next instant, the center can seem to resurrect itself, gravitationally pull awareness into itself. And before you know it, in the split second, in the snap of a finger, there you are again. As that center. Now, once you've seen beyond it, you will be much more porous. It will not have the same grip on you. It may have very little grip on you. You never know from person to person. But there's something about, you know, whatever we call the center, as I said, ego, self, the me, whatever. I mean, these are all sort of quaint little words, aren't they? All you do is see that you're not the center. It's all so lovely, isn't it? All so simple. You are pure consciousness, pure awareness, whatever, presence. I mean, that's great. It's all true. You know, if you haven't done it, go ahead and see it. It's very life-changing and liberating. But since I talk about that all the time, I even bore myself with how much I talk about it. I didn't think I'd do that to you this evening too much, you know. You can do it. One can do it for themselves. But the center isn't just a little... To say it's a psychological process isn't quite to give it the kind of suchness that it actually has. It's a psychological phenomena. It's a mental thing. It's gone when you stop thinking about it. But it's what it is more than that, is it not? To say it's a psychological process is not quite to give it the entirety of its due, is it? I mean, in your own experience. Because this center is composed of something that's, of course, part of the psychological process, part of the movement of mind, but it's something it's rooted very, very deep, which gives it its core energy. And that is your will. The will is what keeps this whole center intact, what keeps it functioning. It's what gives it its ability to resurrect, even if you've seen beyond it, even if you've awoken from its dream. Your will is a is a very simple thing too. Your will is an energy, is it not? Will? I want. I don't want. I like. I don't like. I'm right. I'm good. I mean, all these, they're actually a movement of a particular kind of energy, right? And this movement of energy, this thing called will, wanting and not wanting, is the thing that within a human being becomes, at a very young age, it becomes a junkie, it becomes an addict. An addict to what I want, to what I don't want. It becomes an addict to things that we value very highly in our culture. The center values things like, what does a center value? Well, being right, that's a big one, isn't it? The center loves to be right. The center values being valued. Everybody likes to be valued, right? But if you need to be valued, you're a junkie. And you know, and you know who your drug dealer is? Everyone you meet. Do you value me? If you do, thank you for my drug. I like you. You're a good person. If you don't, get away from me. You don't have my drug. I want nothing to do with you. We don't usually say that, do we? We just act it out. Right? Approval. Who doesn't like to be approved of? Right? Approval's fine, isn't it? Right up until the point that you need it. And then you're an addict. Then you're a junkie. Then you're hooked on it. And you're dependent on the world. Like every other junkie, they're dependent on something outside of themselves for their well-being. So now you become dependent on approval. I need approval, otherwise I start to feel very nervous. I start to feel ashamed. I start to feel unworthy. I start to... You see? Does this make sense? You know, human beings, there's a very intense psychological withdrawal symptom that goes on when we don't get the drugs that we need, that we've been addicted to, right? When we don't get love, we don't get approval, we don't get... Come up with a few, you know what they are. They're all within everybody's experience. Being agreed with. And of course, where the center is addicted to power, control. Loves to have power, loves to have control. Which, of course, makes it feel very out of control because it never has the control that it'd like to have. Not for long, you know. So the center, the me, it's addicted to these qualities. The addiction is also part of its will, part of its basic, the energy that moves it, that gives it life, that gives us the appearance of something very vital and very real, almost very solid. Right? And most of us human beings will spend our entire lives trying to placate and satisfy this inner addict to different emotional states that can only be acquired through other people. Some people see what I'm talking about, but sometimes then oneself will have a reaction. It'll go, well then, I'm taking all of my toys, I'm going home, I'm going to be an island unto myself. I need nobody, I need nothing, I'm completely independent, leave me alone. Right? A very retracted me. Right? The problem is, it still has the prime addiction, which is to itself. Now it's an island unto itself. Right? If anybody's ever found themselves in moments like that, you know that it's not an answer to anything, is it? It's a profoundly contracted, lonely, desolate, isolating kind of existence. So all these kind of addictions, they're movements of energy. They're movements of feeling. Like I said, want what I don't want. That's the movement of the will. The center always trying to achieve something, become ennobled, become worthy, become... Well, in our culture, we seem to have this very strange addiction to celebrity. That's why every time you turn on the TV, there's a celebrity program. Because people tend to think, if I just had enough celebrity, then, God, I'd have all these people loving me. I bet I'd feel really good about myself. Go ask Charlie Sheen about that. Go ask probably about 99% of the child actors that grew up in Hollywood. A lot of them have a really difficult transition time in their lives. Because it's one thing to go through life saying to yourself, I never got all of what I wanted, whether it was material possessions or love or approval or whatever. I never got what I wanted, and the suffering of that story. It's something entirely different when you can at some point go, I got pretty much everything I wanted, and it's not nearly enough, and I'm still miserable, and I got everything. That's a very, very difficult experience. Very difficult, eye-opening, because then you don't have the luxury of the illusion where you can believe that adding more will make you happier. Whether it's more stuff or more wealth or more friends or more success. When you've got to the top of the heap and you realize it didn't solve your dilemma, you're really in trouble. Because then you can no longer believe in adding more unto yourself. You know it doesn't. You know it doesn't solve the problem. Not very many people get to that place. Not very many people get that successful. But when people do get that successful and they haven't seen through those vital addictions of self, then they're extraordinarily miserable. Doesn't mean that everybody that becomes successful is miserable, because some people in the process of their life become less addicted to themselves. So, you know, the old teaching goes, and it's the same today as it ever was, one of the best teachings to engender a type of fundamental shift in who you take yourself to be is that you don't have to change yourself. You don't have to change anything. You don't have to become. You don't have to purify. You don't have to. In fact, the only thing you have to do is stop doing all of that. It's the only thing you have to do is stop doing. It's not a new teaching. There's nothing modern about it. It's been around for a very long time, and it's beautiful because it's very true. It takes absolutely nothing to have a profound moment of spiritual clarity, of spiritual awakening. For a lot of people, that comes as a shock because they've spent a lot of their time trying to be worthy of God or guru or whatever. For them to see all that efforting actually is the only thing that ever got in the way can be quite surprising. But that old teaching that there's really nothing you have to do to awaken except stop all you're doing, all you're becoming for a moment, is beautiful in its simplicity and in its power. What's not usually said is, although it takes absolutely nothing to awaken, it takes absolutely everything to become, as strange as that may sound, through and through what you realize. I don't mean it means that you need to become a perfect person. It has nothing to do with that. That you become any particular type of person. Because that would refer to the center, the me, needing to become something. But when I mean it requires everything to actually live that, embody that, is it takes all of the center. It takes a complete consuming of the center. disillusionment of the center, dissolving, a disappearance of the center. So I've always seen this with a bit of humor. It's kind of the ultimate bait and switch maneuver. You want to taste enlightenment, kid? It takes, costs absolutely nothing. You get in the door free. But once you got in the door, there's going to be another booth. And it's going to say, I want all your money. I want everything. I want your whole entire inner world. So it's not that I wrote this down. Everybody finds it out for themselves. Because it's one thing to wake up, which is actually, waking up is a very apt description. Waking up from this little bubble of me, because it's all it is, a little bubble. When you're in the bubble, it's your whole world. But when you wake up, then you realize it's just this little psychological phenomenon floating in the space of consciousness. So it's literally you wake up and out of it. That's the movement, up and out. Doesn't mean that that bubble has necessarily been as affected as you might have thought, because the bubble's still going to be there. You may become Mr. or Mrs. All Transcendent Glorified Consciousness, but there's still that bubble there. It's called your human life. Still there, isn't it? Going to work, earning a living, raising the kids, whatever you do. It's still there. It's still there's still a human existence happening. And I think many of us, I can speak for myself, many of us had a notion when we began, a notion that we didn't even think very clearly out in our head, but we discovered that we had it later, this notion that all I need to do is wake up, have a moment of waking up from delusion, and that's going to be it. That's going to solve my whole dilemma. I will then be enlightened, and, well, everything will probably be pretty damn easy from there on. Right? It's the hope of the center. Right? It's the desperate hope of the center. And unfortunately, it's the sales pitch for enlightenment of all too many teachers. I was quite surprised to realize that the waking up part was actually like my teacher had told me, and I hated this when she told me this because it seemed so awfully, god-awfully depressing. She said, yeah, waking up means we've just begun. See, I thought it was the end. And even though she told me it was the beginning, I thought, well, you say that, but that you don't really mean that, I'm very sure, you see. It's the end. Well, in a certain sense, we were both right. It was the end of something. It was the end of sort of the inner center seeking, constantly seeking. If it's really authentic, it's the end of that desperate movement, reaching out. It's the end of that because we see that that doesn't define us. So it is the end of that. But it's also the beginning of something. As I say, because you wake up from this little bubble, your human existence, it doesn't mean that your human existence has any idea how to manifest what's beyond it, the infinite expanse of being. And for most people, in order for that little human, that humanness to be able to really manifest what you really are, the center is going to have to dissolve out of that human aspect. And once you awaken, you will feel the pressure for it to dissolve. Yes, you might be able to go back into the purest expanse of presence, let's say. But if that center, it's not, you may not even be identified with it, but it can still keep going when you're not identified with it. Not in the same way, but it can keep going. It's one of the most common questions spiritual teachers get. I know I have had the realization of what I am. I know that I'm pure consciousness or pure spirit or emptiness, and I'm it's so clear and it's so obvious in my room by myself, whatever. And then, you know, some moron that right there tell you the center is coming back, you know. And then I have to interact with somebody, I have to go home for the holidays, I have to go to my job, I have to interact with people, and then it all seems to go kind of haywire and confusing and gets very strange. Very common, isn't it? See, as I said, I think most of us had an erroneous idea of what spiritual awakening was really all about. Most of us start off thinking all sorts of things, but it's some element of freedom, whether we see freedom as union with God, or we see freedom as waking up from identification with separation, or however we see it, however we package it. We see enlightenment as synonymous with a sense of freedom, of well-being, of a direct experiential contact with the sacredness of existence and beyond. And many of us, overwhelmingly, probably most of us, we thought that that's, or we think that that's basically what it's about. But it's only later that we realize at a certain point that that was just a necessary stopover. It was like a layover. You know, when you're taking a plane flight and you lay over somewhere, it was a temporary place. It was something that was necessary. Discovering your innate freedom and well-being and always and already completeness wasn't an end in and of itself. You thought it might have been an end. When you experience that, you feel like it's the end, but later some other movement starts to happen. Some other movement that couldn't happen, literally could not really happen until that was realized. And only then do you realize the whole waking up thing wasn't so that the center could feel really good and happy and enlightened and everything. That's not really what it... That's what it was about for the center, for the me seeking enlightenment. That was its idea. But from the idea of the all, of the reality, not the center, but the reality. Even waking up isn't simply for its own sake. It is so that can express itself through that human existence. And it is every human being, in their own way, feels, if they're sensitive, feels that intuitive urge, almost like a seed planted in the ground and the little stem is coming through and breaking apart the last grains of soil, and it's breaking through trying to get on its way up to the sun. And the seed might have thought, all I want to do is get past this soil, this confining soil. There's freedom up there. I can sense it. I can feel it. There's space and sun and beauty. And then it breaks through and it goes, yeah, I've made it. I've broken through. I'm no longer confined to this small world of soil and darkness and earth. I've I'm now in the great expanse of being. I've realized the sky and the sun, and wow. From that perspective, the perspective of being buried deep in the soil is just feels like a prison that you escape from. And can you imagine that that little bud, that little thing that just sprouted, as it opened up and it thought, that's it. That's what it's for, baby. I've done it. I got there. Right? And there's a truth to that. There's a truth, because if it stayed under the soil, it would die. Right? As Jesus said, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. And if you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. It's a very poetic way of saying to a seed, if you don't make it to the top of the soil, you're toast. You will die blind. Right? But the seed is, when it finds the top of the soil, it thinks it's all over. Only later does it discover, no, it wasn't just about getting to the sun. That's what I thought it was about. That's what I was going towards. That was everything I ever wanted. But then later you discover, no, it's not about that. It's about what can come from that. Whether it's the tree, or the fruit of the tree, or the stalk of corn, or whatever it is to become. In other words, it didn't stop as soon as it saw the light of day. The light of day actually allowed it to fulfill the fullness of its potential. Maybe to grow into a 100-foot pine tree. Maybe to simply express itself as a weed in your lawn. But to express itself was its journey, was its reason, was why it had that urge to break through into the freedom of the light of day. And it's a metaphor. I'm using it as a metaphor of a human being, the seeking of our own freedom, which is so available, and yet that it doesn't stop at that freedom. The freedom allows something to come into being. And that's why once you break free, once you come home from, I call it coming home from the spiritual honeymoon. Right? Because anybody that's had an awakening, they know what I mean by the honeymoon. Right? Ah. God, it's so damn obvious. How did I miss this? This is glorious. This is lovely. You know, I mean, you got the get out of jail free card playing Monopoly. You know, that's it. Better than that, but you know. That's not a very good metaphor. But then at another point, you'll find it putting that very light of presence, that light of being, that very freedom itself, will start to put pressure on your human vehicle. It's like, because it seeks to express itself through that. That's what it seeks to do. It's not a personal agenda, you see. It's not a person trying to become enlightened and a total embodiment of God's goodness. That's all the center. Existence uses that impulse too, so it's fine. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, as Meister Eckhart called it, that simple ground. That simple, silent ground where distinction never gazed. That seeking its not just its realization, but then later, in the fullness of its spiritual maturity, its expression. And in order for it to express itself, whatever remains of the center, even if you're not identified with the center anymore, whatever remains of the center will feel a greater and greater and greater pressure to dissolve, to fall away. And this is the thing that I find so many people have difficulty with, in part because they simply do not understand what's happening. And they try to solve the problem through just staying in the clear expanse of being, as if that's the goal and the end point. And yet the movement of it at some point, when it may be weeks or months or years, but at some point the movement of that freedom will be right back down into that pinhole we call human incarnation, and it will be like that seed that sought the sun, not for its own sake or its own freedom, so that it could express itself fully. And it's that which every human being feels. Generally, we start feeling it from the center, the ego. You know, I want to be something. You know, and that's the ego's reflection of a deeper impulse. It's the ego's experience and the reflection of the impulse that comes from existence. And it has been my observation when I started to experience this, and I, like I said, this came as a surprise to me. And boy, for it to be able to do that, it is a clearinghouse. It is a rootering. It's not just a dissolving into the well goodness of God. It's maybe for the, you know, very few beings that have the karmic inheritance of a small gnat, you know. But for the rest of it, everybody else, for the rest of it, it's often not quite that simple. But eventually it takes the entire center away. It takes everything you held on to, everything you wanted to be, every definition you wanted to have, including being an enlightened person, an enlightened being, and all that spiritual stuff. Eventually, it just takes it away. And we have these examples, too. We have had these examples historically of this very process. The problem is, we take the examples, two of which I think for me are the most obvious, Jesus and Buddha. As it's been said long time ago, you know, Jesus wasn't a Christian and Buddha wasn't a Buddhist. When Jesus came, there wasn't Christianity, you see. He was born a Jew. Okay? And he broke through, and he didn't just wake up from. That obviously wasn't the trajectory of his life, was it? Because if he had just woke up from, you know, he would have just had the dove descend, you know, at the river, and okay, enlightened, thank you, I'm done. My life mission has been complete, and I'll just go, you know, sit by a river until it's all over, or whatever. But that wasn't it, was it? There was a bit of expression of that truth to happen, and that expression wasn't most people's idea of an enlightened life, I don't imagine, you know. I wonder how many people would be chasing enlightenment if they knew that their enlightened life was going to be pretty much just like Jesus Christ. All your friends and people that love you, and they'll, when it really comes to it, they'll all desert you, and they'll even do worse. They'll pretend like they never even knew you. Not only don't I like the guy, but I don't even know who he is, or she. I've never met him. No, I have nothing to do with him. No, nothing with him. Everybody around you will get so pissed off because you won't fit in any of the boxes. They'll say, what are you? Well, are you Jewish? Are you Christian? Are you this? Are you that? What are you? And they can't put you in a box, so they'll get really pissed off at you. And they'll end up, you know, beating you up, hanging you on the cross until you die. Okay, now here's the line for enlightenment. Anybody first? You see, no, nobody's signed up yet. Anybody? It's easy to miss that maybe the most significant thing that was brought in that life was something creative, new, different. You see, it was an expression of the infinite. It wasn't a duplication of anything. It wasn't a product of something that had come before it. You see, it was existence. It broke through and expressed itself. And yes, there is a human way that played out that most people wouldn't want to have to live through, but nonetheless, it did that. And so it has this extraordinary impact on human, especially Western civilization. Buddha was the same thing. He tried all the religions of his time and utilized them, and he woke up too, but he also became an expression. There was this new and, at the time, revolutionary teaching. So he wasn't just reproducing the old. There was something that existence was able to come through and not just be realized, but express itself. And the power of that, again, we're talking about these people over 2,000 years later and what they brought in. And it's been my observation that part, existence trying to break, not only wake up from its own illusion, but then manifesting itself, is something that speaks to us on a deeply unconscious level. It's what attracts people often in a very unconscious but very, very, very powerful way, because it ties in with our own deepest, deepest, deepest nature. Unfortunately, what we do is we forget what they did and we try to copy them. And I have not ever found in that freedom of existence that it has any inkling to copy anything or anybody. That's not part of what it's interested in. But that's what we do, right? I want to be like that. Like an existence, you can almost hear it just going, oh, good Lord, really? Didn't we do that already? I mean, this is infinite, ladies and gentlemen, you know. From existence standpoint, it can pop them out just right and left, you know. Okay. I've probably rattled on long enough. And I just say, I don't say this, of course, to convince anybody, because, like I said, nobody taught it to me. It came as kind of a surprise. And when I say that it's existence expressing itself, I don't mean it as it expresses it. Most of the time, it's going to express itself in a way that, you know, most people will not take notice of. It has nothing to do with becoming well known or famous or people noticing you. I imagine for every, you know, one time that it expresses itself like a Jesus or a Buddha, it expresses itself thousands and thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of times in a grandma that nobody remembered very well. You know, or a best friend or a bricklayer or, you know, in other words, this has nothing to do with how well you're known, how charismatic you are, how much a celebrity. It has nothing to do with that. That's purely a human concern, has nothing to do with existence. Any more than a pine tree sits out there waving its branches going, look at me, I made it. Aren't I cool? I'm 100 feet and there's not another one like me. Do you know, it's not. So sometimes when we use these examples of people in the past or even the present, they often leave a false impression that existence really wants to be noticed and charismatic, and it's not any of that. It happens to express itself that way sometimes. But it's completely beside the point. And so it takes a certain courage to stop enough so that consciousness can wake up from its identifications. It takes another kind of courage for that to completely allow itself to manifest through that pinprick we call human existence. I'll end with this. I remember reading some time ago, there was a wonderful book written by the great mythologist Joseph Campbell. Probably many of you remember him. He did a lot of wonderful programs on PBS and wrote a lot of books. He wrote a book called, I think it was Thou Art That. Yeah, it's one of his smaller books. And in part of this is an interview with him. He's dialoguing with somebody. And he was trying to make a point. He was trying to convey something that, as we all know, when we're trying to convey something important, it can be difficult. And he used his own marriage as a metaphor. And in his own way, he wasn't saying it exactly like I'm saying it, but in his own way, he was trying to convey that the infinite doesn't simply seek its own recognition, but also its own expression. And he had this very curious way that he utilized that. And he had said, he talked about his marriage, and he had said that he had a wonderful, at that point, I think he had been married for 40 years, and it was a wonderful marriage, and he said it had been the priority of his life. And then they asked him, well, okay, then they got the guy asking about marriage and love, and he said, and right in the middle of the question, he stopped the guy, and he said, look, marriage is an ordeal. And mind you, this was somebody who had a good marriage, right? This isn't somebody that like went home and struggled with their wife every day. I mean, he'd just gone through basically telling you that he had this wonderful marriage and love, but what he was conveying when he said it's an ordeal you go through. It transforms you. It makes you into something that you weren't before. That's what he meant when he was saying this. It's an ordeal. It's a transformational process. And he was trying to get the questioner, the guy, the person he was in dialogue, to start to realize that it wasn't just about experiencing the beauty and the expanse of love, but it was also about, and that's a lot for most human beings to achieve that. Very few human beings will even achieve that with another human being for any sustained period of time. You know, you love your blissful love, you know, high school butterflies in your stomach, but, you know, anybody that's been in love knows that that's not really love. That's like, let's get them together so they can keep the species going. But nonetheless... love comes later. But it feels like love. So what he was saying was it's not just about love for its own sake, even beautiful, selfless love, but the ordeal part is that it makes you, it has the power, it has the potential to transform you, you see? So you're not just an experiencer of love, you're actually an expression of love. You see what I mean? And the ordeal was necessary so that you could be an expression of that. So he wasn't using ordeal in a negative way at all. It's a very, very positive way. So I suppose that was a very wide-ranging rant, wasn't it? So let's see where you're all at, if there's any questions. Come on up. Where were we going to have the questioners, Mike? Right up here?
Yeah, come on up to the front.
Yeah.
Adia, I want to inquire about nothing. And I've pondered, I've got this notion or concept of nothing, the void, the emptiness, and I have a sense that's something to do with that center that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. And as I searched for that, nothing showed up for me. And I kept thinking that nothing's going to occur for me in some way that I could recognize. Mm-hmm. And at one moment, I got that nothing is probably not going to occur to me like something.
That's right.
So I was looking for something.
Yeah.
And right. That was an insight, a big aha for me.
Absolutely.
And it kind of ended my search for nothing. Mm-hmm. But it it also left me with some insecurity about it. It seemed like too simple, mm-hmm. and it seemed like nothing is supposed to be rich and full. And like I just wonder if I can rely on that insight that nothing really is nothing. That there's mm-hmm. nothing there for me to have an occurrence of. And I haven't got anybody else to ask, by the way, so I'm...
It's a lovely question, actually. I love it. It really is. Mm-hmm. Huh. See, I have a certain hesitancy in me to say what I'm going to say. I'm going to say it anyway. But, and I'll tell you why. But, of course, nothing... There is more to nothing than nothing. Mm-hmm. In other words, the deepest nothingness, it's not like just a nothing like, you know, an empty box, like nothing in there. Mm-hmm. Or you look out into space and, oh, there doesn't seem to be anything in there, right? Of course, we now know that in empty space there's a hell of a lot of something there. But so often at first glance, at first experience... Right, we experience kind of what might be called the nothingness of nothing, mm-hmm. the emptiness of mm-hmm. emptiness, right? And that's very common, right? But and that emptiness, what issues forth from that emptiness, or we could say it's aspects, right? That there is a richness to it, not a thingness to it. But there is a certain type of richness. Now I say I hesitate because the center will then look for the richness.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Or like the center goes, can I depend on this? Well, mm-hmm. no, center, you can't really depend on anything. You mm-hmm. see. Most importantly, you can't depend on yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You see, because you stop every time you stop thinking. So. Eventually can be at any point, but the fullest realization of the nothing is when we start to see that the nothing and the something
are one. Mm-hmm.
That they're actually at a certain point we realize nothing and there's nothing and then there's everything else.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain point sometimes in realization where I like to say you get the entirety of existence down to a nice manageable duality
mm-hmm.
where you may realize that you are the nothingness and then there's everything else. So you only got two things going on. But at another moment, we may have a much deeper scene that we see that the everythingness, the actual physicality of things is itself nothing. And the nothing is itself everything
yeah.
that exists.
I kind of got that as a concept, you know. And how is that experienced? I mean, Does that occur for you, like everything, nothing shows up as a non-dual experience for you?
You know, to tell you the truth, I don't think about non-duality a bit.
Uh-huh.
You know, it never occurs to me that there's non-dual anything happening. It has been different at different moments, at different times. In other words, at first it was almost a shocking moment of realization. Because if we see something, we experience something that we've never experienced before, it has a certain shocking quality, right?
Yeah.
Aha!
Yep.
Right? It's like if you've never been thrown in a swimming pool, the first time you get thrown in, when you hit the water, it's going to be like, woo! But if you have a swimming pool in your backyard, you're going to jump in and it's going to just be like, okay, you're in the water.
Mm-hmm.
So there can be moments of, you know, the recognition is powerful, but that's not the moment-to-moment lived experience. That wanes because it becomes, it's like human beings don't walk around going, hey, I'm a human being. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes so ingrained that after, even though it's sort of a delusion to think that that's all you are, but nonetheless, you know, after a while, it's like, okay, I'm a human being. Let's stop having a party about it. It's... Right, it becomes sort of obvious, you know, after a while. So even oneness is that is to degrade it to a certain extent, but there's a certain sense like that. And really, it then comes down to it's an intuitive recognition. It's not something our minds could ever think
mm-hmm.
of. And it's not like anybody that sees that emptiness is form and form is emptiness, as it says mm-hmm. in the Heart Sutra. It's not that when you look at this, that me and you are seeing different colors or textures or designs or anything. There's just an intuitive apprehension or intuitive, is that the word? Okay, thank you. I'm looking at somebody to tell me. An intuitive apprehension that this that appears to be something is the same as the nothing. But, you know, if I went to my thinking process is like anybody else's, that it exists within duality, all thinking does. And so my thinking process, it can't put those two together. But the seeing, it's like an interior vision. There's not even two things to put together. It's just, oh, they're the same.
So great. I thank you for that. I guess what I'm going to take away with me is that non-duality is probably a kind of ho-hum anyhow. And life will go on, and I'm going to kind of give up my seeking of non-duality.
Follow what is intrinsic to you. I can't overstate that. I say it often, and what I mean by that is I think the most powerful thing that each person has is what's alive in you? You see, what's intrinsic? Like I ask people all the time, what's this about for you?
Yeah.
Don't let me or non-duality or this or that, don't let anything define that for you. Because then you're just being, you're chasing a sales pitch. You're chasing something that's not, but when you go, wait a minute.
Yeah.
What's this about for me? What no teaching gave me, nobody cajoled me into, nobody convinced me, nobody enticed me, but what's this? And when you allow yourself to define that completely within yourself with no reference to external authority or to stories or to ideas, then you are in touch with the most potent transformative force within you.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, God,
that's
thank
it.
You.
You're very welcome.
Yep.
Thank you. Yeah. But the realization of emptiness itself is very, very powerful. Very transformative.
Thank you. Hi, Ajahn.
Hi, good evening.
I have two questions, and the first one's kind of simplistic, but...
Good.
It's like, it seems like we're always having to choose, or at least I'm choosing a lot, even just to be here. Mm. You chose to somehow figure out how to get here.
Actually, I didn't. But somebody else did.
Well,
so your idea is still correct, yeah. Or it seems to be, yeah.
My question is, who's choosing? And, you know, when you talked about the will, to me that's like the chooser.
Yeah, will is a kind of chooser. But there's no chooser behind the will. There's nobody exercising the will. It's just will is just an energy. It's inclined towards this, and it wants this, and it pushes away from that. There isn't somebody behind it. That's the illusion. There's just the energy itself, the movement itself.
So the me choosing. I mean, like, you know, when you think about higher self or lower self, like the lower self wants some chocolate, maybe, and
yeah.
But
I don't think of things in those terms.
Okay.
Yeah. Higher self's a better delusion. Okay, you know, more functional, higher, a little bit more adult. More
like I'm choosing vegetables instead of chocolate.
Right, right, right. I mean, psychologically, we would call it the superego, right? The sort of parental kind of supposedly more wise, you know, ego.
So really, the will is me. The
me, it's me in the terms of the false self.
That's what I'm...
That's its core existence, is that movement of energy. I want, I don't want. But even if you got rid of those concepts, it's a movement of will, right? A movement of energy, which is... that is what propels the egoic state of consciousness. And of course... I had no understanding of this. I don't think we can have a real understanding until the will has either greatly diminished or disappeared. Only then do we know, my God, my entire existence was a product of that movement, of that thing we could call will, that energy, what I want, what I don't want, towards and away.
So did you want to be here?
Did I want to be here? I don't even think of things in terms like that, to be honest with you. I really don't.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, I love being here, but, I mean, quite truthfully, if you ask me, would you rather be here than somewhere else? I mean, you know, everywhere is just about fine.
Good.
That makes sense. So, you know... In other words, you know, the thing about choice really can, it's very easy to get confused around it, isn't it? You know,
you are confirming what I had felt. I just don't quite know how to. And then it begins to become a not choosing.
Mm.
And that's not it either. Because then you're sitting there in the grocery store going, maybe the spirit wants me to choose apples and rather than mangoes. Or,
right, you know. Right. And then you're trying to figure out what, right? As if the world really cares. Anyway, but that's very common, isn't it? I mean, there's a lot of people in this audience, I'm sure, that have had moments like that. You know, you're there and like this way or this way, and the thing that makes it difficult is our mind thinks in these very divided terms. Should I do this? Should I do this? Does whatever word you have, does God or whatever.
Spirit,
does it want me to do this, and does it want me to do it? You know, and it gets very much into should and shouldn't and right and wrong. And when that's just seen, oh, there's no winning the argument. You never have certainty. Right? And if you do have certainty, you're stuck in a deeper state of delusion. Right?
Mm.
A fundamentalist is certain, aren't they? Right?
Yeah.
I mean, during the Inquisition, the Inquisitioner was certain. Right? Okay, so certainty can be extraordinarily dangerous. But when we realize that this this movement of mind, should I, shouldn't I, this or this, which way is right, which way is wrong, is there a truth, you know, all this, that we just see it for what it is, just this kind of a, it's the movement of division in our minds at a very subtle, and then we see it.
And then maybe sink into where, like he was talking about, where you just were saying to this gentleman about finding that what is maybe your deepest pull.
Well, you could use it in this, but I was talking about it in a little bit different context. But if we just relax, trying to get it right, trying to know all that stuff, right? What's the right way to go? What's the right decision? What does God want me to choose? Whatever. And we just relax that. See, okay, that's the movement of division. And we don't judge it. It's just the mind. Poor thing, it just does the best it can, right? And we don't try to get rid of it. We don't try to transcend it. We just let it be. As soon as you let it be, you become, you and your instrument, which is your whole being, you know, even your physical existence, you become much, you're already more sensitive. And when you become, now your instrument is sensitive because it's not caught in this divided mind thing. And when you become sensitive, our bodies are extraordinary instruments, manifestations of spirit. And then you can start to feel that there's simply, I call it an inclination, not an egoic inclination like I want, but it's almost like you're there and you just feel something moving there. See what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's just a movement. But the thing is what, and this is happening in everybody. I think most people are so caught up that they don't feel it. But even those, when they start to feel it, when we feel this movement, the problem we have is then we go, okay, how do I know that's the right movement? And so we want it to give us confirmation, right? But that movement, one way you know, or it's not a, you can't use this all the time with certainty, but probably over 90% of the time, that movement, or sometime it can be like the still small voice, as they say, that movement will never justify itself, will never tell you why, and will never give you guarantees. It's just a movement, right? It's like going into a river. If I get into that movement in the river, is it going to take me anywhere? Is the river going to say anything to you? Give you any guarantees? Have any relationship with your mind? You either go with it or you don't. So that's like a navigational aid. And when you realize that the thing that will justify itself, and you say, yes, this is the right direction. If it says that, at least a yellow light, if not a red light. Right? Because mind, ego will usually give justifications and certainties, right? And give you all this feedback that'll try to make you feel good about your decision. But you just realize, and pretty soon you realize that this, you get more and more in touch with this flow, and you realize this flow is much more intelligent than the mind. It's actually choosing without a chooser. And eventually, you get sort of, I didn't even know the word, so integrated into that, or so at one with that, that the thing that's noticing the movement sort of collapses, and then there's just the movement. That's all there is. There's not a watching of it, a seeing of it, a detecting it. But that's where it starts usually. And as that gets honed and well-developed, then the thing that's going with the movement and noticing the movement starts to just kind of like, shh. Pretty soon there's just...
You become the river.
You become the river. Yeah. Yeah.
Do I have time for the second question?
I don't know. Do you?
I do.
Okay.
This is a little more difficult for me to explain. I've been studying a lot about the feminine and the masculine. Mm-hmm. And my understanding of that is feminine is form. Mm-hmm. She is love. She is light.
Mother of the 10,000 things.
Yeah. And the masculine is more focused. It's like, get on this train and get across this river. Mm-hmm. Or, I guess, train and river. Boat and get across this river. And it feels to me like sometimes when I'm studying different teachings, you and maybe not so much you, but I'm studying a lot, I get this idea that the ego is divorcing the form, the feminine.
Mm-hmm.
And what you just said now, it just feels like it's more, that fits with what I feel, like it needs to dance together. We can't divorce the form.
No, well, they're all the same. It's all the same. That's why I'm saying also the expression, remember that during my whole talk, that it's not just about transcendent realization, that realization will then, in its own way, it will seek expression through that form to become embodied, to be a form.
Yes.
Right? That's returning into the world of form. You could think of that, of course, as more as a more feminine movement, I suppose. Yeah.
And that, yeah, it just kind of confirms that for me.
So. Yeah. Yeah. And different people will have different expressions, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I know, say, some women spiritual teachers are extraordinarily masculine in what they are conveying. Some are much more feminine. And the same thing with male teachers. Sometimes you get the very feminine qualities and not, you know. Spiritual teachings that are all transcendent. Wake up, wake up, wake up. No form, no body, no mind. It's a very what would be considered very masculine.
Exactly.
Right? And it's the movement of a sort of masculine, what we would think of as a masculine kind of energy. Very, very necessary movement. It's just as necessary as the other. Is to see that all transcendent voidness is also the world of form and shape, that they're actually not even married, not even together, but they're actually the same thing. Do you know? They're actually the same thing. So, and that's part of what I think people's own spirituality is, we will have our own personal preferences, and part of the movement of spirit completing itself is it has to go past and break through our personal preferences, whether we have preference for the transcendent or we have preference for the immanent. Since reality is one, it's all one, that we will all confront our own preferences, you know, of our own incarnation, our own makeup, and we will, hopefully, we will allow it to move beyond our own preferences. And then, because only then do we get a really full vision, you know?
Thank you, Arjun.
You're very welcome. Yeah. And also, as you kind of really start to see this stuff, you kind of just, at a certain point, you get to see that different people expressing, you know, their spirituality, whatever, certainly different spiritual teachings. Sometimes what wants to be expressed by some teaching is an absolute masculine expression, right? So that life can have that, existence can have that as what it wants to do. Sometimes it can be a completely masculine. So it's not like it should be whole and, you know, and real well-rounded. You know, that's an idea of how it should be, too. Sometimes it's an entirely, what we'd think of as masculine expression can be very powerful, and an entirely feminine expression can also be very, very powerful. Actually, you put them together and it gets much more harder for people. That's what I found, that when I just talk about waking up and you're not the body and you're not the mind and you don't need to make effort and you don't, all this kind of stuff, it's much more simple for people than when I give them my whole vision. And then I go, okay, you woke up to nothingness. Now, well, let's just keep going, shall we? Let's see that nothing is everything. And then, you know, for a lot of people, then they kind of go, well, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. I thought it was all nothing and I thought everything was void. And does that make sense? So actually, a more well-rounded vision can actually make a more difficult presentation, more difficult spiritual teaching. So Because it's more it seems more contradictory or paradoxical, you know. But actually, it's not, because it's just our mind that thinks in dualistic terms and then has a hard time putting things together, right? They can't really... Well, how can something be nothing and something? How can it be nothing and everything? And the mind goes like... It just can't, you know. But in Zen, what we call prajna, heart wisdom, in that other wisdom that's not of the mind, but is a very deep and profound wisdom, there's no putting together these opposites, because from that heart wisdom, there is no opposites. So everything is already together. It's not apart. From the thinking mind, everything is apart, and it's trying to put it together. From reality, things aren't even together, because there's not multiple things to put together. It's one. They can appear as many. See, I told you it can be confusing. Or maybe not. I hope not. Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you for being here. So I'm a little nervous, so I hope it comes out right.
Oh, hello, nervous.
Hello. Part of what really draws me to your teaching is that you talk about the work that happens beyond just waking up.
Yeah.
And so I guess I was hoping that you could speak a little bit to my particular situation.
That's what I was going to ask you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Having just... I feel a little bit like I'm stuck. You talked about that metaphor of having gotten through the first door, which mm-hmm. is free admission, and then getting to the booth where you realize that you have to give away everything. And I feel like I'm maybe in between the two.
Mm-hmm.
You know, having waken up and then wanting to run back into bed and put the covers over my head and pretend like it didn't happen. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so I think
what are you bumping up against?
A lot of fear is there.
Yeah.
A lot of fear. And a lot of reluctance to give away everything.
Yeah. Makes sense.
It does make sense.
From the perspective of the me, it makes sense, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Like, let go completely into that? Well, I won't exist, and there's no guarantee, and I can't possibly know what will happen if I was to do that.
Right? Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So from that perspective, it makes... I always find it really useful to, when we see whatever we want to call it, whether it's a contradiction or a contraction, or whether we call it a delusion or whatever, it's useful to get inside of it. Because when you get inside of it, even something that's very diluted, it has its own logic. It makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. So from the me's perspective, what you're talking about and what you're experiencing, which you probably know many people experience, is it makes sense. Right? From the me's perspective, yeah, you're damn right. Why would I completely let go?
Mm-hmm.
Why would I completely let go and be... dissolved into nothing and not even be around anymore? Why would I? And there's absolutely no guarantee from my point.
Mm-hmm.
So once you kind of can let it have its, not just see it, but like you understand it, like, yeah, it has its own logic. It's not like it's completely deluded. Inside of that viewpoint, it makes sense.
Of course, but then there's also, you know, you see that, you see, yes, I don't want to let go, so I'll go back to bed and pull the covers back over my head.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't just stay there.
No, it's way too late for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah. It helps if you know you're like on an inextricable trajectory towards the inevitable. Right? I mean, you can put the covers over your head, you can say no, you can say I won't let go, you can contradict the entire movement of the what you realized. And, you know, the best you can do is leave claw marks as it drags you completely into itself. Right? That's But you're not going to stop anything. You can slow it down a hell of a lot, but you're not going to, you know. I mean, your fate was signed long ago. You completely renounced any control that you never had anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, there, as you said, there can be a great fear with it, right? A great fear.
Absolutely.
A terror, even. A very stark, stark, stark terror. Now, there's different ways to deal with different kinds of fear. But the kind of fear that you're talking about is an existential fear. You're getting that, when you've seen as much of you as you've seen, the center is down to its existential core. And the core of the center is just, it's just like this. It's a grip in the gut. Mm-hmm. That's all it is. It's just a great big raging no, which is what it always was.
Yeah.
No to life, no to death, no to letting go, no to not letting go, because that's too difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's just, because that's what causes separation, is a contraction by nothingness in nothingness. And at that level, you can't soothe it.
No.
At that level, the point will come. It could come 1 second from now. It could come a year from now, or who knows when. But the point will come when you'll experience the same fear, the same contraction, maybe even much greater. But something inside of you, not decided in your mind, not premeditated, but it just will arrive because the capacity has been built for it, and it will just arrive, and it's sort of like something just says, okay. I'll die. Okay. Let's just do it, for God's sake. Okay. It's not courage. It's not a masculine thing. It's not feminine. It's not a loving thing. I'll love fear into non-existence. That doesn't work. This is too deep, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is too deep for that. It's just, but something in you gets, it's like a capacity that gets born in you, and it creates, and when the capacity just hits a point of maturity, it just meets that fear, and everything that fear could threaten it with, it just has a very, very simple okay. And I can't tell you how to create that, because your mind can't create it. But it will be there. It is being created. It does happen on the inside at a very kind of unconscious level. And when it's ready, it just arises. And I mean it literally. The interesting thing is, when it arises, it doesn't arrive from the top down.
Right.
It literally, physically feels like it arises from your gut. It arises here and moves up.
Right.
And it just goes, it arises in the gut, and it just says, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Or something similar to that.
Yeah, times before where I've encountered that fear and sort of hit that brick wall, it's definitely been top down.
Yeah.
It's been trying to think through it, or be okay with it, or,
yeah,
you know, reason through it, or see it with love or compassion or whatever. And it just nothing is working.
No. No, that's why I said there's different types of fear that exist at different levels. But at the level you're at, the existential level, there's nothing, there is no technique, there is no dancing around it, there is no spiritualizing it. It's just this, and when the thing arrives in you and presents itself to your consciousness, that just says yes to everything that fear could threaten you with, a simple yes, then it's done.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't create it. But it is, the capacity is being generated. It is there, and it will arrive. It will come. It will come. And sometimes what really helps it is when the thing up here, the mental thing, that's trying to meet it and doing all these strategies to do it, when it knows, no, that's not enough. That may have worked in the past, but no, it's too deep for this. When this knows that trying to get the right relationship with fear is just not necessary, it can't find the right relationship with it. When you know that, the relaxing of that attempt can really help the arrival of this other capacity, this very, very simple capacity. Because here's the strangest thing, is the yes, when it, remember I said it arises from like the gut up? It's because it arises from right in the middle of this, of the clinch, of the tear. That's why when you wake up, when you've had your, you know, you wake up, there may be stuff there, right? But and then maybe the fear arrives, and you can kind of go, well, I'm the space of being, and there's this hideous fear and everything. But it doesn't stop the fear, does it?
Mm-mm.
It lets you transcend the fear for a while, but still it's there.
Well, and what I've discovered is that the fear shuts this down. This only lets this last a couple days, a couple weeks.
Terrified
and
of it.
It shuts it down every time. And this is, I mean, it's been a cycle of years now.
It's terrified of it. It's terrified of it. Because it views this openness as death.
Yes.
And give it its due. It's right. It's true. It is. It's not the kind of death you have in mind. It's not near as threatening as it thinks it's going to be, but it is a type of death. When you wake up from your dream in the middle of the night, what happens to the you that was in that dream?
Disappears.
Toast. End. Mm-hmm. Deceased. Dead. Non-existent. Dissolved. Right? Mm-hmm. So it's a type of death. It's a very real, but is it a big deal? Once you woke up in the morning, like the death of the dream isn't like you're not sitting there going, oh God, let's have a funeral for the dream that just died. It's kind of like, what was the big deal all about?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I can tell you, yeah, in the end, ultimately, it's all like a nightmare in a certain sense. And when the yes comes, you realize it was nothing. But that doesn't help you.
No.
No, that's it's like you have to go through it yourself. You have to realize it yourself. Because you have to meet it in its own reality where it feels 100% real. Where you're no longer making any attempt to transcend it, to be outside of it, to be bigger. You've completely given all that up. Because when you have, you see the yes, as I said, curiously enough, arises from the very center of the no. That's why it comes from the gut up. That's why trying to transcend it away or love it away, that's all outside stuff. You can't, and what you need is the access of what's inside the terror, not what's outside the terror. And the yes literally kind of allows consciousness, it collapses into the center of the terror, but right there, that's where it finds the yes. That's one way, and I think that's probably going to be your way.
Okay.
The other way is if you just happen to be kind of put together. Oh, we're going late, but if you just happen to be put together in such a way that you have great faith and trust. Some people, very few people, but some people just have incredible trust. You know, they have a trust in God or something. They just trust it literally with their life. Their feeling would just be, I have absolute faith in God. And if you have that, go with it. So it's going to be one or the other. Absolute faith. Problem with absolute faith is you can't create it, you can't fake it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You got it or you don't. But absolute faith, that's kind of the easy way. If you got that, go with it. Or the other way is the way I'm talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's where you actually just, you have to allow that thing to arise, the yes.
Mm-hmm. And that seems like that's just a matter of waiting it out.
Yeah. As anti-non-dual as that sounds, It's actually, I found this to be the case.
Yeah.
Because I could, we, me and you could play, do hocus pocus things. We could, I could like inquire with you and you could have a little cathartic moment and it could look good for everybody and you could feel good and we could all go home deluded that, that you have totally dealt with this.
Right.
Right? But what I know is next week or tomorrow or by the middle of the night tonight, it'll all be back. And, you know, since I don't do this for entertainment, we're not going to go through that charade.
Okay.
Do you know?
Yeah.
But sometimes just knowing what the parameters are of how something unfolds is can be helpful. Not that it allows you to do something, but it can just be helpful. You know, like, oh, okay. Something's going to come from the center here, from deep in the middle of the terror. That's where the yes is. The yes is inside the no.
Okay.
I wish you well.
Thank you.
And I don't mean that threatening, as threateningly as that sounded. All right. And by the way, no one should be pushed into that kind of terror, too. I've seen that. I've met people who've had teachers that have done that, who've said, you know, just dive in and all that. That's not a good idea. It's not a good kind of terror to really push yourself into. It's not a great idea because you may not be ready for it. I've seen plenty of people get pushed into a kind of terror that they have not developed the capacity to handle, and then it actually sets them kind of backwards. So it's a natural thing. It's the yes will arrive naturally. It is there. It's already within you. It's just finding its capacity. Yeah. Okay. Gosh, I'd love to sit here for another 2 hours and talk with you. It'd be lovely, but it is a little past time, so I suppose we should go. Lovely to be here with you. Really enjoy you. Maybe I'll see a couple of you tomorrow. You never know. Namaste. Thank you.